So turning first off to the First Amendment, if you look at the First Amendment, there are five basic freedoms that the First Amendment provides for. The First Amendment itself states that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So first we have religion. Second, or abridging the freedom of speech, so the freedom of speech. Third, or of the press, so that's three. The right of the people to peaceably assemble, that's number four. And finally, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. A lot of people make note that when this particular amendment was drafted, it includes both the freedom of speech and the freedom of the press. Both of these were sufficiently preserved in their own independent essence. So the freedom of the press itself is equally important, or it was co-equal, to those founders who drafted this particular amendment. So not only did they want the right of the people to actually have the opportunity to speak, to voice their concerns, they wanted to provide for a free press. And in essence, Justice Potter Stewart said that the First Amendment speaks separately of the freedom of speech and the freedom of press, and this is no constitutional accident, but an acknowledgement of the critical role that was played by the press in American society. The Constitution itself requires sensitivity to this role and to the special needs of the press in performing it effectively. So under that sort of an umbrella, the recognition under the First Amendment of those freedoms is absolutely critical. And as we're sitting here 50 years after the Sullivan case, a very critical case in First Amendment jurisprudence, this is even more true as we're dealing with this new iteration of online journalism. When you look at the news today, you'll probably see topics including Snowden and some of the leaks going on there and how the Pulitzer Prize just related back to those leaks. So some of these online presences and online issues and the high level that technology plays in today's news gathering and news collecting is just, it's something that emphasizes that importance, the fact that the press is absolutely penultimate in the nature of this freedom on the First Amendment. So looking at the First Amendment and turning then to the media and how the media interacts and uses technology and uses the online avenues available to it, let's take a look first at just some general statistics. In 2008, not terribly long ago, but if you look at what platforms were important then, you know, MySpace, which is all but deceased at this point in time, the importance of the BlackBerry, so we see how technology has ebbed and flowed. But even in 2008, of the top 100 newspapers in the country, 100 of them had an online presence. They all had videos. 100 of them back then had videos. 40 had podcasts. 93 had blogs that were run by their reporters. If you took a look at that statistic today, you would find that, again, all of the top 100 properties still have a significant online presence. Where their podcasts were important then, they have changed over to videos. So the ability to interact with the readers, to interact even with the broadcast journalists on TV stations with their viewers, has just become heightened in importance, and almost every news outlet has some sort of connectivity with its followers and with its readers. As of 2011, 71% of online Americans are using video sharing tools such as YouTube. So if you look at the statistics, there is this massive growing sense of onlineness, this connectivity, and they're using this. The news media is using this to their advantage to reach people. And the first base of people who are actually using the internet are the reporters, filing content online. You have all of the different websites of the news reports themselves are filed online. You can see videos. Even the traditional print media, the companies that still publish newspapers, have access to videos and post videos online, so you can watch the content, listen to the reporters talk about their story. and do so in an interactive sense where they're trying to engage their readers. A lot of these broadcast journalists and reporters have their own Twitter accounts. They'll follow you, they'll retweet you, and try to engage you in discussion. And this leads to a lot of potential issues. When you stop and think about it, who owns that content? You have a news reporter who's working for a news station. One of the base issues we run into in the media law is who owns the content, so whoever types the blog, who owns the connections and the followers, and who owns the actual account. In the UK, one of the biggest on-air personalities was a BBC employee. She had several hundred thousand Twitter followers, and she went to work at the competitor's news center. And you had better believe the BBC was ready to file suit to try to get those followers back. Just think of the massive amount of potential revenue-generating people that just migrated with her when she changed over, and the loss of access to that followership that she took with her. So these sort of issues are really catching on day by day as you find that newspapers are trying to enforce more authority over their reporters in understanding who owns that specific content. Although that might not be the most exciting issue, there's another one that couples with it, and that's editorial control. In the old days, you had a copy editor who would sit slavishly working over the reports that were filed by the reporters, making changes and tweaks. At this point in time, who's doing the copy editing on a tweet? When you have someone sitting there just sending it out, there's no one necessarily providing any control filter. And this was absolutely the problem that happened in the case of the referee Bill Spooner and an Associated Press individual who filed a tweet saying, in essence, that it was a bad call when he was sitting at a basketball game. So after this bad call comment, the referee, Bill Spooner, was absolutely upset and irate and filed suit against both the reporter and the people who had deep pockets. So he filed suit against the Associated Press. Well, $20,000 later, after the Associated Press wrote the check, you realize the issue that even a Twitter account in the hands of a reporter can be a potential issue and could be potential liability for those newspapers. So from their side, from the publisher's side, and from the owner's side, there's a lot of considerations over how much authority a reporter should or could have using their Twitter account. So that's a major area of concern to a lot of journalists today if they are affiliated with a network or with a newspaper. But another fun issue, one that I think is going to play out more and more, is getting to the source. And this is applicable whether you're a blogger or whether you're an actual reporter with journalistic credentials with some newspaper. I'll give you three examples, and let's think about how these are all might impact you or others. You know there's something going on at a large university. Doesn't matter which university you choose. You know there's an issue, there's a story that you're wanting to get. So you set up a Facebook page, pretending to be a college student, interacting with the college students so you can stay connected and be the first one to get that information. Now, there's a case going on right now that's dealing with this particular set of facts where someone drew out a college student to get more information on a school shooting by setting up a fake account. Now, you have questions of journalistic ethics, of course, but the fact that you can use an online source like Facebook, Twitter, or any of the different platforms to reach somebody is an interesting new twist. Another example, take any of your potential problem solver type news stations, and they set up a website where they're looking to draw out the bad guy. And this has been done before. A sugar daddy type account is set up where they've drawn people in, but under completely false pretenses. Again, journalistic ethics questions, but what else does that impact? Let's look at the last example, the third one. Is anyone familiar with the Ashley Madison website? Ashley Madison is an affair website. It is set up exclusively to try to set up intimate rendezvous between individuals when they're out of town on business, or even if they're at home and they just want to get away for an affair. There is an issue with one journalist who set up an Ashley Madison account to try to lure people in and to expose them, much like the old television show Cheaters. So what sort of things and issues, what legal issues and ramifications are there? Obviously, there's journalistic ethics questions. But when you look at it, when you sign up to Facebook, when you sign up even to Ashley Madison, there are the rules of the road. There are the terms of use. In that case, particularly the Ashley Madison case, there is a provision in those terms that normally people just click through and say, yes, I accept without reading. There is a provision in there that says that you cannot use this as a journalist to try to find people or to weed people out. You have to be a serious person who wants to use the website for the purposes it was set up. So number one, this reporter's in trouble because they just breached a contract. Number two, private facts. You've collected a truckload of information, a lot of private information about these individuals, whether it's the college students, whether it's somebody on the Ashley Madison site who's potentially thinking about having an affair. You've collected a lot of information about these individuals. And the more you expose, the more risk you have to a privacy-based lawsuit. And that's the reason that we know about some of these Ashley Madison issues. An individual is suing because you've just exposed my private facts. It's a right of publicity issue. So digging into these things, getting to the source, can be a potential huge issue for anyone who is an online journalist using those online sources. Another area that is so easy to delve into for either a reporter or for an online journalist is copyright and trademark violations. I can't tell you how many times I've picked up the phone talking to a journalist. Well, hey, it's been around long enough. It's been on the internet forever. The internet owns it, right? You know, you go to Google Images and you pull things up and you find all of these free for downloading images that I can just use in my news story. I could just copy something somebody else has already written and use that as a potential just as my potential base for my story. Well, the problem with that, of course, is that old concept of copyright law. And this is where the internet is far too easy to go and access material. I mean, most people aren't thinking I'm just going to go and grab an entire chapter from 50 Shades of Grey and post it on my website. Something like that's pretty much over the top. But grabbing a quote here and there without attribution or using it in a context that doesn't qualify under copyright law is far too easy and far too dangerous a thing that happens all the time. As a matter of fact, there's a very big lawsuit right now going on with BuzzFeed. Anybody familiar with BuzzFeed? They took a conglomeration of 30 pictures of people playing soccer, and they made a collage out of it. And it's just a 5x6 set of images that are all related to soccer. Well, one of the individuals in that 5x6 image of different collage image was upset because they held the copyright over that photo. So they sued. At this point in time, it's still working its way through, and the determination will be made as to whether this is fair use or not. But this is just another example of how easy it is to link to something or to copy something that is potentially an infringing material. I think one of the good examples is Quentin Tarantino and his latest script, The Hateful Eight. Gawker and several other parties put links to the original script. So you're linking to an infringing website that uploaded the entire copy of his script. So now, if you're clicking on this link, and it's gone, so you can't find it, but if you were to try to click on this link when this file was still there, you are infringing copyright law, you know, by the posting of it. So the person who actually posted it is infringing and violating copyright law. So since they shared the link, Tarantino sued Gawker and a whole bunch of other entities that had something to do with the posting of that material. Now, back in February, Gawker filed a motion to dismiss to try to get themselves out of the case. Now, Gawker ended up winning, but it'll be interesting to see what happens with all of the rest of the people to make a determination of whether just simply dropping a link to another website is copyright infringement. Stop and think of it from that perspective of a reporter just putting in a link back to an original copyrighted photo or a link to an original copyrighted work. Think of your blogs linking to the same type of material. Important case, a lot of things are resting on that decision. Similarly, we have a link that the folks at Harper put up of a photo of a famous celebrity. Very, very similar case, very similar issue. So within the next few months, the dynamics of this area of law could substantially change. And that's what's exciting about it. This is such a dynamic area of the law, and it is changing on a daily basis. And there are a lot of nifty cases that are just pressing it into the front. And that's where Twitter and Twibel, as they like to call it, Twitter libel, comes into play. And this goes back to the reporters and the story I told you about the referee, Bill Spooner. But there are other big cases. Lord McAlpin in England. Has anyone heard of the Lord McAlpin case? Gentleman who was accused by the media of having slept with someone and having an affair, in essence. Proven really not to be true, and it was more than an affair. It was actually accusations along the lines of possible criminal sexual issues. So people who retweeted the information and made accusations, he took a look and found everyone who had retweeted or tweeted about this entire issue. He went and looked to see whether you had 500 or less followers, because he thought that was a perfect number. If you have less than 500 followers, just issue me a formal apology and we'll call it even. If not, he was asking for the equivalent of $150,000 per individual who had tweeted something in his mind that was libelous. It was defamatory. Now, granted, this has happened in England, and there was another case with a cricket player where someone in the media had put out some facts about a cricket player that were somewhat inaccurate. And they went after that reporter for $150,000 as well. And it really hasn't hit the U.S. very much. And most of the cases, like the AP case, have settled. So this is an area that is definitely a potential issue, and we'll have to see as time goes by whether anything really develops from it. So the other nifty thing about most of these websites, the news-generating websites, is they have plenty of room for comments. Posting comments from users. And I want to take a quick aside and talk about what the Internet does to people and how people act on the Internet. I like to call this segment, "She Blinded Me with Science." Interactions online really do differ from face-to-face interactions. And there was a study done by John Suler in 2004. He called this difference in behavior the online disinhibition effect. And really it boils down to six key points of why people act differently online versus in public places. First off, he calls it "you don't know me." This is disassociative anonymity. If you don't know me online, I can say anything and you're not going to find me because you don't know who I am. So that disassociative anonymity, you don't know me. Number two, you can't see me. I'm just a name on a screen. You can't actually see me behind the curtain. Invisibility is this factor. You won't see me until later. A little synchronicity. Since you're going to see this comment long after I've posted and left the site, I will react differently and type and act differently. And besides, it's a game. It's all going on in my head. This is sort of an interjection. So it's a game. It's going on in my head. There's this disassociative imagination. And, oh, by the way, there are no cops. So you're minimizing authority. These factors add up to some really interesting online content. And when you start moving into the area of user-provided comment and contents, it's an interesting space. Have you ever looked at any news articles, particularly the political inflammatory ones? And I love to read the very political Detroit newspapers because you'll get the extremes flushing out on any topic that has any political relevance. You'll get both sides just exploding on each other. And you wonder, would you really say this to somebody if you were standing with them face-to-face and in person? And for the most part, People generally wouldn't. And when it comes to online news and online newspapers, you have to ask the question of how free should I allow my comment section to be? How much liability could I, as a journalist with my own blog, or a blogger myself if I have open comments, or even a newspaper or a news station, how much liability am I risking? From that standpoint, a lot of people have those good old click-through terms of service. So you're under contract to talk about things the way we tell you to. But yet you still get people posting copyright-violating material. You still get posts that are defamatory. Now, the nice thing is we've got different provisions, and Congress has set forth a few different laws that protect people from that type of comment. If you have copyright-infringing material and you're the host of the blog, you have some safety. You have the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, where as long as you're notified and you take down that infringing material, you're in good shape. But then you get the risk that's going on YouTube right now. You always hear about some of the recording artists and some of the Motion Picture Association folks who are very, very aggressive at trying to protect the content. So you have to balance what the right amount of content and taking that type of material down and what that does to you. Also, on the flip side, if somebody posts something defamatory on your blog, on your online news site, or even on, again, one of the stations locally, they have the right to take that defamatory content down. And they're immune from suit for that type of content. So they have, under the Communications Decency Act, the ability to protect themselves, unless they do some crazy things. And there's some really great examples. Quiznos and Subway. Now, granted, this isn't news, but this kind of sets the parameter for what's going on and how we treat things. Quiznos was having a competition, and they wanted to show everyone why we're better than Subway. So they asked all of their customers to go out and make a video. Show us why you're better than Subway. Well, Quiznos made a video. And their video was really attacking Subway. And it was encouraging anybody who was going to upload a video to be aggressive, to be really, really decisive, and set out just an unhealthy tone. And boy, did people do that. Some of the videos that were posted were completely over the top, accused Subway of doing all sorts of things, and really were defamatory under any definition of defamation you could imagine. When the courts got this, they said, well, we have the Communications Decency Act that usually protects whoever has the website, whoever controls that, whoever publishes the material. But there's a difference here. Quiznos, you encouraged the behavior. You actually enticed and induced people to put that type of negative material up. Now, this case has been interpreted in our area within the same circuit that Michigan is under in a very interesting case called TheDirty.com. Anybody familiar with the website called The Dirty? As you can guess, it is a gossip page, and they encourage people to post the dirt of what's going on in their area. Well, a lot of people from the Cincinnati area posted comments about a particular Ben Gal, one of the cheerleaders for the Bengals. And this cheerleader is a teacher by day and allegedly had a relationship with one of her students. So there were all sorts of comments flying on this website, including one suggesting that questioning why teachers are so crazy in the sack. Naturally, she was a little bit upset and sued. So immediately, this citizen journalist website, I guess you can call it a citizen TMZ, said, hey, Communications Decency Act, we didn't do anything. She's definitely somebody who is of interest to everyone. She's a good public figure. And, you know, by the way, somebody else typed this, go after them. Well, they said just by the nature of it being The Dirty, they were encouraging the content. They were encouraging defamatory content. They would, the author or the host of the blog also suggested in several different ways some topic areas and really encouraged and was engaged in this activity. So in our area, this is the state of the law. If you're encouraging, if you set up a news site or if you are a blogger that's encouraging this type of an issue, or if you're a TMZ-esque type organization, online news is a totally different world because some of those protections that we used to think existed, at least in the Midwest, may not necessarily exist. Now, this is one of the biggest areas that the coasts are fighting. They hate this case. They absolutely dread the idea of any publisher being held to any standard to watch the content of those people who post on their site. So I would keep your ears tuned in and listen for anything. If you're ever creating a website and you're worried about what you're putting up there and what you're encouraging, that's a big area under the law. So we'll move to kind of the last and most important section is the idea of citizen journalists and bloggers. And since it's a small group, I'm going to take just a minute to ask, is a citizen journalist really a journalist? What do you guys think? Are bloggers actually journalists? Anyone think that bloggers are indeed a journalist?
Depends. Some, I think in this community, some are. I think some are the best journalists I read are bloggers in the community more so than the paid journalists. But it doesn't necessarily mean you're a journalist.
So from that standpoint, you're suggesting that just because you blog doesn't make you a journalist, but if you follow those journalistic ethics, create well-developed material, you could be just as journalist as a guy with the credentials. Well, there's actually a couple of bloggers who have been noted by the United Nations and given press credentials. So it's not unprecedented. But there's a flip side to that. Is anybody who sets up their own shingle, just types away all day, should they have the same credentials as somebody who spent 4 years at journalism school? It's a good debate, and there are a lot of people who fall in different areas. And even those who do the blogging or who do free commentary for the newspapers really think they should be treated more like journalists. Not too terribly long ago, AOL was acquired by the Huffington Post. So HuffPost picked them up for $315 million. It's a pretty good number. A lot of money going back and forth, and a lot of the bloggers who had given free content saw that and said, well, clearly, we're the ones who are providing the content. We've obviously done something of value. They've just acquired the company for millions of dollars. We should have the opportunity to get paid for our work. So they filed suit against the HuffPost. That case didn't get very far. Those folks were treated as, in essence, volunteer writers who weren't entitled, despite the fact that they were creating content that was being posted. They were not actual employees, and they weren't due either any benefits or actually any money at all. It's not really a settled area, but for the most part, unless you're someone looking for a true journalist job, making sure you have a contract is absolutely important because everything seems to suggest that anybody who's a blogger, it's fantastic to do that work, but you're not necessarily, at least financially, going to be looked at as a journalist. But on the flip side, Congress recently addressed this issue, dealing with some of the issues of the press. And many of the senators and many of the Congress people who spoke on this issue clearly made the fact that the bloggers and the journalists are really in the same camp. There is no distinction. So as time goes by, citizen journalists and bloggers are treated more like journalists than just the simple blogger. So that really leads us to kind of a question of, if you are a blogger, if you are a citizen journalist, what areas do you need to pay attention to and what do you need to know? So obviously, understanding a little bit of copyright law is important. Knowing that photographs that you find on Google Images aren't necessarily free for use. The fact that things like Creative Commons are a fantastic place to properly use licensed images. And again, understanding the difference between things that have to be attributed or cannot be used for commercial work. So understanding all of the precepts and concepts behind those types of copyright issues, absolutely critical for those who are hoping to set up their own journalistic and online journalistic setup. Another key area is understanding privacy law. This is an area of great flux, and it's probably not going to change anytime soon, but it's very interesting. anytime a journalist or anytime anyone is dealing with the privacy interests of an individual, if you're publishing or talking about a story that has to do with someone's health, if you don't have the full rights or permissions to tell everyone what conditions someone has, or if you have social security numbers, or if you have that type of personal information, you have to understand the risks of those types of disclosure. And what's exciting is the fact that the last time Congress worked on those types of laws, back in the 70s and 80s, they haven't changed much since then. Many states have passed state-specific laws, but again, only 46 states actually protect your personal identifying information. So as a journalist who's digging into these sort of facts, understanding what you can and can't publish is critical as well. And one of the other niche and entertaining areas is recording the police, and particularly in the state of Michigan. There was a case recently that addressed the recording of the police, and let me pull up a couple notes that I have on that case because it is so interesting. First off, if you're out there filming the police, if you have a camera phone and you're filming and you want to upload the video either as a journalist who might send this video to a news station or even for your own use, you've got to know the statutes, and that's eavesdropping. In Michigan, you're risking a 2-year felony or a $2,000 fine or both for unauthorized taping and filming of private conversations. And that's really interesting because you're using any device deliberately, willfully, to film what's called a private conversation. Recent case, the People versus Stone, suggests that if you're in a public space, if you're in a restaurant, if you're in a bar, that's not private. So to film something that would violate the law, it's very, very rare that it happens anymore. If you're in any sort of a public space, you likely have the opportunity to go ahead and film free and clear. But if you are in a private space, you do have to have consent of both parties, unless you're a party to the conversation. In that case, you can film away if you want to, because Michigan is a one-party consent state. So if you are the one who has an interest in filming, you're part of the conversation, you have the absolute right to do so. But now, filming the police, you want to make sure wherever you're at, you're present lawfully. The statute suggests that if you are someplace where you shouldn't be, you're really running the risk of trespassing. And that's potentially 30 days in jail and $250 per offense. If a police person comes up to you and asks what you're doing, you're not required under the law to talk to the police. They don't have the right to ask you for your identification. They don't have the right to say you're not a journalist, get out of here. That's not the way Michigan's law is set up. Moreover, if they say, please stop recording me against the law, that's not factual either, and stand back, that's the only thing you have to watch out for. If you're recording during an event, during some sort of transpiring news event, and you're in the way, failure to follow a command, a lawful command, is obstruction. Again, another 2 years, $2,000 potential penalty. Be the master of your technology. Make sure you're comfortable with the technology you're recording, and you can capture video if you're being forced to walk back or step away. So recording the police in Michigan is definitely an interesting thing, and really the laws are actually in the journalist's favor, whether it's a true journalist or a citizen journalist. And posting those videos online, absolutely allowed from a standpoint of that type of journalism. It's the cutting edge of what's going on today.
So if you're in a situation where you had the right to be there, please ask you to stop recording, and you didn't, and they were to be upset by this, and let's say grab your phone and take it or throw it, would you then have a legal case to sue them for that?
So the question was, if you're lawfully in a place where you have the right to be, and you're recording, they tell you not to record, they take your device and either delete the images, throw the phone away, do damage to your device. It's a challenge. You have the right to be there. You have the right to get your phone back. Part of the problem is with a suit like that, you would have the right to try to sue them, but if they were acting under the color of law or could prove that they were acting properly, you might not get very far. But from a standpoint, that's something that they should not be doing. You probably could sustain a case. Any other questions in general? Anything you want to hear more or you're interested in particularly with online journalism, with online activities?
I did want to clarify the recording in terms of public versus private. So you said that if you're in public, that it's pretty much fair game that you can videotape or audio record conversations or what's going on without permission with other people. But you said then in private space, that's not the case. But then you said unless you're part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're part of the conversation and you're in somebody's home, you're saying that you have the right to record that conversation even if they don't know you are?
Even if they don't know you are, even if you do not have their consent. Michigan is what they call a one-party consent state. So from an eavesdropping or from a wiretapping perspective, as long as you are a party to the conversation, you have the right to make that recording without any worry or retribution under the law. Remember, from a standpoint of when I say no retribution under the law, that never stops a lawsuit. So you always have to be ready and prepared to defend yourself. But from a standpoint of having the law on your side, the way the statutes in Michigan are drafted, you indeed are allowed in private situations to record if you are a party to the conversation.
And then does that mean that then if you share that, you also have the right to then not just record, but share that definitely well?
Absolutely. It seems to be an odd kind of turn of affairs, but Michigan, along with many other states, have adopted the one-party consent rule, and it's very helpful for those who are in the news space or for those who are bloggers and looking to expose information. You know, we've heard of the case of an individual who walked into a township officer's, a township official's office and just set the iPhone down with it recording and had a conversation about graft and corruption and got some very juicy quotes and remixed part of it and put it up. Oh, did they get the phone call? Please take that down? Absolutely. Did they get the nasty lawyer letter saying we're going to sue you? Absolutely. Did we send them a nasty lawyer letter back telling them what the statute allows? Absolutely. Did they go away? Begrudgingly. But they did. Begrudgingly.
You mentioned where you have to be part of conversations, so your voice has to be heard like in a private setting that you mentioned?
Well, it's not so much that necessarily you have to have your own voice on the tape or you have to be able to film yourself involved in that conversation, but it's, you know, imagine if you're at somebody's house and you're at a party and you've swept away into a side room and there are two people talking about, let's just continue with the graft and corruption. You have two people on a county board, they're talking about some sort of scheme. If you're not a part of that conversation and you record them, you are at a position where you're not properly recording. But if you were sitting there talking with them, even if you've stopped talking, but you're part of that discussion at some point in time and you're involved in it, that recording is absolutely and definitely arguably, depending on whether the conversation pushed you out, as long as you're a party to that conversation, absolutely.
Right. So long as they're addressing you, even though you're not saying anything.
Well, yeah, even
if they're
even
addressing if you, they're, you know, say for example, like slandering you, calling you names, and you know,
oh, yeah,
just remain silent, just so you know,
absolutely.
So you don't say anything that will be used against you. So that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
You know, you may have a difficult burden to try to prove that you were part of the conversation, but just your presence is definitely helpful. Any other questions at all on online media, journalism, and the internet today?
I'm a little curious. When you're browsing Google Images and you come across an image, most of the images I come across say may be subject to copyright.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where that ends.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean don't use those images?
there are some times that you can use them, but let's start with just kind of the basics. If you take a picture and you put it online and it gets captured somehow in a Google search and it's picked up as one of the images, you would have copyright rights to that particular image. You may not have filed a federal copyright, and you may have the right to go back and file a federal copyright, and you have the right to do that years afterwards. You don't have to file it within a certain amount of time. So that person could and may have copyright rights to that image. So that said, when can you use it? Fair use comes to play, and there are really four main fair use factors. You're looking at things like the purpose and the nature of the work, the character and how much substantiality you're using it for. Are you using all of it? Are you using a little bit of it? Are you getting to the heart of the material? How does it impact the market? Things like that that are addressed under the fair use analysis. Sometimes people won't come after you. They may not even know. But if you're using it just hypothetically for commercial gain and you're using it, freely distributing it, and it's going to impact the market, you might run into trouble. Classic example is a very recent case. It's a 2013 case. I think it came down in October. Associated Press versus the Meltwater News. Meltwater is, in essence, an aggregator. An aggregator are these guys who just go around and scoop up all of the news stories, and they republish it. They put the headline, they put some of the lead, and a chunk of the story, maybe 100 words of the story, and they sell that to their clients. Their clients are companies, they're businesses who want to keep up on any time that their name is used in the industry. So General Motors right now would probably be getting news stories off the cuff with the all of the issues and the congressional hearings. So Meltwater would gather all of that and provide it. But they're stealing straight out, so the Associated Press alleged. You're stealing our material. You're taking the lead. It's something that we worked so hard on to create, this great lead and the story. Yeah, there are facts in there, but they take the heart of the matter. They're taking the heart of the material. Well, the court agreed. So they found that activity to be copyright infringement. So unless it's something that's transformative, which ironically, on the flip side, there's the Google case, Google Books. They found that Google Books was transformative, that Google scanning parts and pieces of works and putting it into a searchable capacity, that is fair use. You know, you can look at the two and scratch your head what the difference is, because they seem so similar. This news agency has grabbed it up and is a direct competitor, whereas Google really isn't competing with the authors themselves. And they are transforming the work because they're making it searchable. Books that, generally speaking, would be found in a library setting, they're making them much more easy to research. So that just shows you how close call a lot of those cases are. So with Google Images and taking those photos, the same sort of thing. What you're using it for, how you're using it, it all is such a complex mess, really, that it depends on a case-by-case basis of what you're using it for. Used to be, historically, that if you're using it for a commercial use, you're almost automatically the bad guy. But we love folks like Jon Stewart for pushing that edge in those types of cases. And South Park did a fantastic job. Not long ago, there was a case that went up to the Ninth Circuit where South Park had lampooned a viral video, the fellow who did the What song. And it was a very, very questionable content video that went viral, and they took the cute little character Butters and put him in the video and parodied the Dickens out of it. And despite the fact that South Park definitely wasn't in it for the educational value, they weren't in it for the preservation of society or any really altruistic reasons. Yes, South Park seems to be about making money. That wasn't dispositive. The fact that it was parody and the fact that it was commenting on this get rich quick by putting a video online made the difference. But a lot of people just go to Google Images, do a cut paste, and never get caught. A lot of people go to Google Images, do a cut paste, and get a nasty letter from Getty asking them for $5,000.
You said that copyright doesn't have to be filed, and I guess I'm curious about that. So if I have an image online, would one thing is I could go copyright that, I could put it on like, you know, have a Creative Commons attribution on there. Is that, so I guess I'm wondering as far as what does it mean to file it, or if I do video work as well. If I, do I need to put the copyright symbol on that video, and does that do it, or do you actually need to register it somewhere, or what is that?
So here's how that works, and it is very interesting. Used to be, years ago, you had to put the little copyright symbol, the little circle C, by your work, or you couldn't enforce your copyright at all. So first off, that rule was tossed out in probably around 1976 with some of the modifications that really modernized at the time, the Copyright Act. If you want to sue, however, and if copyright is a federal claim, if you want to take someone to court for infringing your copyright, you need to have a federally registered copyright. Otherwise, you can't sue on it. Now, you can go on ahead and register it later, but if you register it within the first so many days after you create or first publish the work, you get some excellent statutory protections. You get, of course, the right to sue under federal copyright law, and whenever you file it, you get that. But you get a presumption that your work is indeed copyright protected, copyright protectable, and you have fewer proofs that you have to jump through. So that's kind of the benefit that you get for filing early. Otherwise, you just have to prove that, yes, here it's been published, it's out there, it's mine, I own it. Now, the other nice thing that you get about filing early, you get statutory damages. And statutory damages can vary. Statutory damages go up to $150,000 per use. So not saying that everything goes at that rate, but you've probably heard of the cases where someone downloads music from one of the websites and they end up with this, you know, they downloaded 10 songs and they've been sued for $1.5 million. That's how they get to that number. So those are some of the benefits. And again, right now, up until the 1st of May, you could file a simple copyright owned by one author for, say, a text work. Now, if you're filing for ship hulls, it's entirely different. But if you're filing just a regular copyrighted work, a single work, $35. May 1st, that number goes up, $55, if I'm not mistaken. But still, if you do have something that you think is going to be a major piece of work, it's worth filing.
So you're saying to file it officially, it's $35, and it's going to go up to 55. Maybe $50, $55.
Yep.
And then, so like copyright.gov, you like actually go and you.
You'll set up. You could set up a profile. Now, I haven't checked to make sure that they're okay under the Heartbleed, but you know, my assumption is you could do a quick check on that. I would assume, hopefully, that their government website is perfectly good. Although the apparently the Canadian tax filing system wasn't, but absolutely.
Okay, then this is all stuff I didn't know. So it seems like you don't need to do this to own copyright. You don't need to put a symbol on there. It's not going to make a difference. But if you want to make sure that you've really protected it, and if you think you made a work that somebody might sort of challenge or go after or want to profit from, then this might be worth paying, because you're paying $55. That's quite a bit of money per piece. Depending on what you're doing.
You know, and there's a way, there are ways to look at it. There was a recent case that suggested that compilations could be filed. If you have multiple photos, you could file it as one work, and all of the photos would be equally equally protected. That was a case that came down, I want to say, last week. So a lot of new and interesting areas. So, yeah, it's the enforcement is what you're buying when you buy the actual federal copyright. It's maybe a little oversimplistic, but you're buying the enforcement right.
Back to using images. Would you be more protected using images if you were a not-for-profit business?
Not really. Just like the fact that commercial use didn't hinder South Park. The fact that you're not for profit, depending on how you're using it, may or may not necessarily help you. That said, it is one of the factors. So if you are not for profit and you're just using something on your materials, it's one of the things that you would argue to try to diminish the aggressiveness of the copying and to say that, see, it was a fair use because we used it for an educational purpose. And that often is one of the areas that is called out. It's specified in copyright law that there is educational purposes you're allowed to use for educational purposes. So when you get into nonprofit area, depending on what you're using in the image for, you may have a lot more latitude, but it depends on what you're using it for and what you're using. There are some people who it doesn't matter who you are. As I say, it may stop the award, but it's never going to stop the suit. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much for your time, and best of luck with everything in your online ventures.